Flip Palazzola, Reel 3.
One of the things that is kind of struck me strange, we had no Technicolor film. So anytime we saw any movies where there were any explosions, the explosions were black and white. And I can remember how startled I was when I saw my first explosions in all this beautiful color. Just beautiful color. It just made a lasting impression on me.
Were you sort of happy with what you were doing in the war? You know, was it satisfying?
Very much so, yes. Yes. I felt I was doing something worthwhile. I really didn't get too much into what my association with the special services was, with going around with the different groups. Because I built some of this equipment and it was working so well, we would set it up. And I remember I set it up for Bing Crosby when he came over. And we didn't have a large turnout, and I don't know why. It may have been that there weren't many bases that could get away at that time. But I would say there were probably a couple thousand, you know. And he came up and thanked me afterwards. He said that was the best sound that he had had since he had been overseas. He was very impressed with the quality and how it carried his voice. So that made me feel very good. I wrote back to my mother and told her about that.
What was he like, Bing Crosby?
He was a very nice person. Yeah, he was very nice. You read things now about him and his family, how he was so rough on his family, but he was a very nice person. Yeah. Very low-key, kind of laid back. Yeah. Very nice. Glenn Miller was the same way. He was very laid back.
Who was that?
Glenn Miller.
Glenn Miller. Oh, yes, you're going to tell me about Glenn Miller.
Well, you know, I did this travel around to a few bases. I didn't go to all bases with the Glenn Miller Orchestra. But I went to a few of the bases with the Glenn Miller Orchestra and enjoyed that so much because I was quite a fan of Glenn Miller. I really enjoyed his music. And a lot of the artists that he brought with him. This really wasn't the Glenn Miller band. This was the Army Air Force's band that he was directing. But he had a lot of good. He had Dinah Shore was with him. Johnny Desmond was with him, Ray McKinley, I'm trying to think of the singer that did Chattanooga Choo Choo, he was with him, I can't think of his name offhand right now, but it was enjoyable, and I could do that occasionally. I didn't do it all the time because it wasn't part of what my requirements were, but I did it just because I wanted to and had the spare time. Whenever Glenn Miller came to a base, there was a big turnout because he was probably the most popular band there. It was this is a little sidelight. About 3 years ago, the BBC released some of the tapes or transcriptions that they had made during the war with the Glenn Miller Orchestra and with Johnny Desmond and Dinah Shore. And these were propaganda music that they were broadcasting to Germany. And as an example, Johnny Desmond sang all of his songs in German. And they spoke to the German people very nice and saying that they would be glad when the war was over so that we could all enjoy the music, enjoy each other, and things would be much better. You know, it was very, very nice. And I found out about these, and they made CDs. You can buy the CD now that has these special recordings that were just discovered probably 45 years after they were made, and they made them into this CD. It was very, very nice.
Did you know anything about that at the time? Were you involved at all?
No, it was BBC Studios in London did all of this.
What was he like to work for, Glenn Miller? You know, how did he appreciate your sound?
Didn't say much. No, didn't say much. But was he's a very quiet man. He was a hard man to try to get next to, so to speak, to become friendly with. He was just—he was very reserved and quiet. I understand he was quite a taskmaster with his musicians, you know, to get them to perfect their music to the sound that he wanted. But, you know, it was to the benefit of all of them. So even though he may have been a taskmaster, he was doing the thing that was best.
Well, was it a very different sound at the time? Today it even sounds distinctive. But, you know, did it make quite an impression, the particular sound he made?
Yes. He had developed a clarinet lead with his orchestra, with the other instruments, and that became the signature of his music, all of his music. As soon as you start hearing it, you know immediately it was Glenn Miller. And that's what caused that was his signature. A lot of bands were trying to do that sort of thing. Some of them did use other instruments, but he was using the clarinet as a lead. And it was very pleasant, very nice music, very enjoyable.
Yeah. When you put on these gigs, mm-hmm. Well, perhaps they were more than that, because you were saying thousands would go, is that right?
Yes.
Would they be all American, or did you invite the locals?
I think it was only the Americans, because most of them were held at the bases, and the civilians were not allowed on the base. Other than people that were working there. There may have been a few of those, but they weren't invited, no. The English weren't invited. Yeah.
And did you have English bands? You know, you mentioned earlier Ted Heath and others. Would
I
they have been?
I'm sure they played at the RAF bases.
Yes, it seems from what you've been saying that you were quite separate from the RAF,
yes.
Apart from your special job of, you know, training the young recruits in electronics. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. Mm. Yeah.
But what was your opinion of the young RAF trainees compared with perhaps what you had experienced in America?
They were enthusiastic. I'm sure they felt that their country was being severely attacked, so to speak, and they wanted to save their country. They were probably more patriotic than a lot of Americans were, because they were working on their own soil. We weren't. Yeah. The old saying that the English had, that we were overpaid, oversexed, and over there.
Were you made aware of that flip while you were there?
But, yes.
You know, was there sort of any antagonism you felt?
I think in London you felt it more than anywhere. Yeah. I didn't spend a lot of time in London. I'd go up to Leicester up there and visit in that area and get away from a lot of the other things. Yeah. That's me, I guess.
Yes, do you think it was asked, you know, this reputation, overpaid, oversexed over here, did some of the Americans perhaps earn that?
Oh, I think so. Oh, we had a lot of obnoxious GIs. You know, there really were. After I'd been there a while, I understood the problems and felt the problems with the English people, and to see some of these things happening really bothered me.
What were the problems you noted?
Well, their crudeness and the way they would talk a lot of times to the English. They were blaming them for everything. They didn't want to be there, some of them, and they were blaming the English that this was going on, that sort of thing. I think there was quite a bit of that. Generally, those types of individuals would stay together. And as a group, they became more outspoken. And because they felt that there was security in numbers, I suppose. And so I just never wanted to get involved with any of that. I just didn't think it's right. So.
And how about Jasmine? You didn't get too involved with Jasmine.
No, just it was a very nice relationship we had there. She invited me home one time, and to her home. And we didn't even just talk. It was just a very nice, pleasant relationship. Actually, she worked as a barmaid. That's how I met her, in one of the Scottish pubs.
When you went to the home, Jasmine's home, would this have been very different from, say, a comparable American home?
Yes. It was much smaller. The rooms were much smaller. The furnishings looked older. It was because they had such a hard time. In England prior to us ever getting over there. And so there weren't a lot of new things, and a lot of things they just weren't available. So it did look older, as I remember. But the people were friendly. They were very friendly. I think it's probably true any place you go. If you smile, of course, nobody smiles back. I think of my meeting with you here. How nice that was, you know, and how that developed into this sort of thing. But I guess that's my personality.
Would you have had any African Americans in your outfit?
No, there weren't any at our base. I think that probably because of the racial situation in the United States, that generally they were infantry people. They were going to be the people that would be doing the fighting. That's where generally they were. It was interesting that they would tell a lot of the English girls that they were the night fighters because they were black. We used to kid about that. But no, I didn't see but very few black when I was in England.
Did that bother you, the racial situation, you know, the segregation between white and black people? Did it impinge on your life? This St. Louis is quite south, isn't it?
Well, during the Civil War we were split. Half of Missouri was Confederate and half was Union. I never thought of it much one way or the other. Because I was so much involved with music, blacks were a big part of music, and so I enjoyed them. I used to go to after hours clubs after the war here in St. Louis when there was still segregation, and I knew some of the musicians, and we just had a real enjoyable time together. So I can remember. In the news lately here, they talk about the Parkmore restaurant closing. That used to be a place where you always used to go. It was a young person's place, and they had good hamburgers, and it was just a real enjoyable place. Nothing rowdy or anything, but just a good place to be and to be seen. And I can remember that there were a couple of these black musicians that I was friendly with, and we'd go to the Parkmore. And they couldn't go in. I had to go in and get the food and bring it out and we'd eat in the car. That's how bad the segregation was. But I was never a segregationist. I enjoyed what they did, and the person is a person for what he does. It's not what your abstract thinking is, what they might be, or an idea that is based upon a very minor group, that you're taking and putting everybody into that category, because no, that's not the case.
Do you remember VE Day, when the day war ended? And I wondered if you had any celebration or yes. How you spent that.
Actually, I was. We were all on the base at VE Day, and they closed the base down. Nobody could get out. Nobody could get in. For 3 days, it was closed down tight. But they had 24-hour movies. They had kegs of beer for us. They just had a big party. It was a 3-day party, is what it was. But we were not allowed to leave the base. I never understand what the reasoning was, but we weren't allowed off the base, and nobody was allowed in. So that was for 3 days. Now, VJ Day, I was in Felixstowe on leave, and I was sleeping. And it was about 12 o'clock at night, and all of a sudden I hear all of this noise outside. And it was VJ Day. And so then we knew the war was over. When VE Day came about, we didn't know what we would be doing as a group. But we all felt that we would be shipped to the South Pacific, to the Pacific area. And so we weren't looking forward to that particularly. But, you know, what is what's going to be is going to be. And so it was August the 15th that I remember being in Felixstowe and hearing all of these noises and firecrackers or something going off, and wondering what was going on. And they said, the war is over, the war is over. Well, then we felt we would not be going to the Pacific. So I was very happy. And it was about 3 weeks after that, I guess the first part of September, that we were sent back to the States. And we came back on the Queen Elizabeth, and there were 15,000 of us on the Queen Elizabeth. They were sleeping in the swimming pool everywhere. But it was an enjoyable tour. It was only like 4.5 days. So it took us 10 days to go over in that Liberty ship, but it only took us 4.5 coming back. When we pulled into New York Harbor, I was so emotional that I cried. It was just, and I wasn't alone. There were a lot of us that were that way. And when you see that come through up the Hudson and you see the Statue of Liberty after what had happened in the world, it just was overwhelming to us. And we were the first large group from Europe to come back after VJ Day into New York. And everyone was out. They closed New York down. They must have. Everyone was out. There were people hanging out of all of the windows of all those big buildings. And all of the tubs were shooting, the fire ships were shooting their water off. And they had the balloons that were a protection against air raids. They had these all over. It was a tremendous, tremendous welcome that we had. I couldn't believe it. And one of the things that I remember is that shortly before the war had ended, an airplane had run into the Empire State Building. And we could see where this airplane had hit up. I don't know how high. It was up fairly high, but there was this big hole in the Empire State Building that we could see. I mean, silly things that you remember. The other thing I remember is how loud the foghorn was. My eardrums just tingled from the sound. But that was a good trip back. We had good weather. It was September, first part of September, so the weather was very nice. The food was good on the board ship, too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's funny how some of them have their bunks set up in the swimming pool.
So So how soon were you demobbed then, Lip? Were you demobbed? Were you released?
From New York, I was flown out to Ogden, Utah. And Ogden, Utah is in the Wasatch Mountains and gets cold, very cold. And here we come. Well, actually, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. When we came back, we were allowed to go home. We had leave. They gave us 30 days leave. Then we had to report back. And we still didn't know what we were going to do. We thought maybe we had to decommission things, you know, take care of things down, that sort of thing. And but I was selected because of the length of time I'd been overseas to be released and to be discharged. And so I was discharged in January of 1946. And but in the meantime, I'd been sent out to Ogden, and here it is in December, November, December, and I was out there waiting to see where they were going to send us. And it was cold. There was snow. There was ice. And coming back from England, after being there 2 years, it never gets that cold, you know, and so it was quite a shock. But then I was released. I was discharged. I had an honorable discharge. I got something that most GIs have stood through it now. I got a good conduct medal. Yeah, and I got another medal for being in the European Theater of Operations, and that's about the only medal that I got.
Well, was the war to prove important for your life, though, that experience and going to England? Did you know, do you think it had effects on your subsequent life?
The training? Only the pursuit of what I was going to do. As I said, I was involved so much with music. I liked music. I enjoyed it so much. And I had the electronics background. And so I went to work for a distributor of electronics equipment. It was a Zenith distributor here in St. Louis, and worked with them. Then when television came out, having the electronic background, they put me in charge of this area of teaching all of the circuitry for television. And so I'd go around to the various small towns around St. Louis. We had about 1,200 dealers who were handling the product, and so we had to let the service people know how to keep them going. And Zenith was different than most other manufacturers. They had their own circuitry. And so I had to go out and give these schools to the service people. And I did that for a couple of years with the distributor. And didn't have to do it anymore because television was here and they knew what to do, they knew how to work. So I talked the distributor into allowing me to start selling hi-fi equipment through the distributorship. So I set up my own little department and I was selling this hi-fi equipment. So that was, you know, so I had all this, it wasn't stereo yet, it was still just hi-fi, just mono. Mm. And
Going back to the war, do you think war helps innovation? You know, the development of radar and that sort of thing. Would that have happened, do you think, without the war?
No. I think the war had an accelerating effect on it. Yes, I think that that any activity where it takes a national effort does do that. You look at the space, what space has done for us, what computers through space have done, what communications have done, our internet and all of that. Those are all developments that were really accelerated because of the electronic explosion that happened after the war. I can remember we put in a computer at this distributorship I was talking about. We had to put in an extra 5 tons of air conditioning to cool this equipment. It took up a room that was 22 by 32. with this equipment in it, and we were just using it to keep our inventory now. It would have been easier to go kind of piece by piece, but we were the first distributor in the Midwest that got this big UNIVAC system, big discs that had the information on it. And, yeah.
Well, Flip, thank you very much indeed for telling me about your experience in the war and going to England. It's been very interesting. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I'm glad I was able to recollect a lot of this, and it's been enjoyable for me to remember these things.
Thank you very much.
Your little story just came to mind that I thought was kind of humorous. When I first arrived in England, we were there about 2 weeks, I suppose, and I had an attack of appendicitis. And they put me in an ambulance and took me 40 miles away to one of our hospitals. And there they removed my appendix. Well, I was in a hospital about 10 days, and it was kind of interesting being in the hospital because a lot of the people that were in the bombers were there with frostbite. And you see these terrible frozen black fingers and black toes and things, you know. That was my first really introduction into the horrors that can happen in war. But the point I was going to make is that when this was all over, I wrote home to my mother and I said, a part of me will always be a part of England. And I'm sure I scared her to death and I explained that I had my appendix taken out.
Sort of shades of Rupert Brooke, that is, isn't it? Thank you very much, Flip.
Thank you.